Okay, hope you guys had a nice weekend. So in this week's experiment, we are going to be doing one of my all-time favorites. I've done this reaction I don't know how many times, and every time I do it, I get excited. We are going to synthesize luminol. And luminol synthesis is a two-step process. The first step is where we take 3-nitrophthalic acid, so dicarboxylic acid, in the presence of hydrazine and some heat to make 3-nitrothalhydrazide. So 3-nitrothalhydrazide is a cyclic diamide. And an amide is another derivative of a carboxylic acid. And just like esters, there are multiple ways in which you can make an amide. And just like esters, the most basic straightforward approach is start with the carboxylic acid and the amine. And just like ester synthesis, this does have a problem, and that is, in this case, our nucleophile, of course, is an amine. Amines are better nucleophiles than alcohols, okay? Unfortunately, they're not so much better that they will react directly with a carboxylic acid to make the amide unless we help it out, okay? So again, the activation energy is still high. Now, you can take the same approach in terms of ester synthesis and amide synthesis. If we start with, say, an acyl chloride, these react very well with amines to create amides. Okay, so just like esters, we can take those same approaches with amides. However, the Fischer approach has a problem with amide synthesis. And that is that amines are also bases. So if we add something like sulfuric acid to an amine, we are going to get the ammonium salt, which is not a nucleophile, okay? There are ways that you can work around this, but they are kind of very special cases, and normally you just simply try to avoid those. So most of the time, amides are made with acyl chlorides or anhydrides or something like that because it's just easier. However, last time, if you remember, I said one of the ways that you can deal with a reaction that has a high activation energy is simply supply the energy, okay? And that is exactly what we're going to be doing with our reaction. We're going to be heating this reaction to a high temperature, okay? So let's talk about the mechanism first. So we start with our carboxylic acid and our amine, and this is kind of the theme of carboxylic acid chemistry. The first product that you create is your tetrahedral intermediate. Now, on this particular mechanism, I drew the proton transfer as one step. It's often referred to as the cheating step, okay? But whenever this type of situation is around, always remember that this proton transfer is a two-step process. So the first thing that happens is that the proton leaves, whoops, think I can salvage it. There we go. So the first step is the proton leaves the nitrogen, and then the next step is the alcohol portion attacks the proton to give us this tetrahedral intermediate, okay? So another way of saying the cheating step is the lazy step, okay? So always remember, if you see that written as one step, it's underneath, it is actually a two-step process, okay? All right, so once we have our water molecule, we now have a good leaving group, and so the next step is simply loss of the water molecule. And of course, now we have formed our amide and water. Now, there is an advantage to doing these reactions under high temperatures. Anybody have a guess as to what that advantage is? I'll give you a hint. Go for it. Exactly right. Good. Because remember last week we were talking about the Fischer esterification and equilibrium and so forth was a real issue. Yes, I've drawn these all as equilibrium steps because technically they are. But under the conditions we're going to be doing, we're going to be heating it above the boiling point of water. So water is simply going to evaporate as soon as it is formed. Okay. And so when we do this reaction using plain heat, we can force the product or force the equilibrium towards product because we're moving the water molecule. Okay. So yes, there are disadvantages to using heat, but there is an advantage as well. And so that's one thing that you kind of need to think about when you're looking at reactions. Everything that you do has an advantage, and a lot of the times it will also have a disadvantage. And you kind of have to weigh, is the advantage better than the disadvantage or whatever? Okay. All right. So, as I said, we are going to be using a lot of heat. What kind of heat are we talking about? Oh, roughly between 210 degrees Celsius. That's not an arrow. To approximately 220 degrees Celsius. And this is a pretty high temperature, what we call a high temperature reaction. And high temperature reactions have some problems. And I think, so what are the problems with high temperature reactions? Okay, well, the first one is how do you keep everything dissolved in solution? -220 degrees Celsius. Can't use water, boils at 100 degrees. Can't use toluene, boils at around 120 degrees. Most of the solvents we have dealt with up to this point have boiling points well below the temperature that we need. So, how do we deal with this problem? Well, there are two approaches that you can take. First approach is pressurize it. Seal it up into a container and heat the container above the normal boiling point of whatever solvent you have. And certainly this happens all the time in labs all over this university. But as I have said all semester long, we don't like pressure because in order to do that, you need to have the right equipment, the right training, and so forth, which we don't have any of that, okay? So although this is an option, if you are working in a lab that has the correct equipment and you have gotten the correct training, then that's a viable option to take. But if not, then we use, oops, this is supposed to be B. Then I'm going to make that smaller. There we go. Then we use a high boiling point solvent. And in our reaction, we're using triethylene glycol, boiling point around 260 degrees Celsius. So that solvent fits well within the temperature requirements that we need. Okay, so the first problem is, how do we keep everything in solution? And we are going to use a high boiling point solvent. The second problem is, how the heck do you heat it? So 220°C is getting to the limits of our hot plates. We purchased these hot plates in about 2003, somewhere in there. It was one of the first major purchases I made in my position. And the reason it was required is because when I got here in 1999, the hot plates / stir plates we were using were roughly 15 to 20 years old, and they were really dying at a rapid clip, and we could no longer keep up with replacing them and fixing them and so forth. So we made the decision, we just need to buy new ones. It's a funny story now, but it wasn't funny at the time. So this again, 2003, the internet was basically pretty much brand new in the terms of websites, okay? So we did our due diligence and searched really long and hard to find a company that sold hot plates with aluminum tops, okay? Now, the reason why we have aluminum tops is very simple. Some of you may work in a research lab or been in another lab where they use a ceramic top plate. Those are much better, okay? But we use aluminum blocks to get the connectivity with our round bottom flasks, and it doesn't take much to accidentally set it on there too hard to basically ruin the hot plate. So that's why we have to use the aluminum tops. And got in touch with this company, talked to them and said, yeah, we sell aluminum top hot plates, and they fit all of our needs. So I ordered 150 of them. And they cost about $500 a piece. Okay, so you just need to do the math. Okay, divide 150 by 2, that's 75, right? Okay, now multiply that by 1,000. That's how much money we spent on these hot plates. Major purchase, all right? We get them in. I'm excited. It's like first brand new piece of equipment for everybody. I'm really excited about it. And none of them work. They won't even boil water. You can imagine my conversation with the department chair, etc., saying, what the heck went wrong? How did you screw this up? And I, you know, again, brand new at this, first major purchase, I was in a total panic. So we contacted the company and we said, hey, you know, what's going on here? They sent out one of their engineers to look at the problem, and turned out we were the very first customer to ever order the aluminum-topped hot plates from them. And as far as I'm aware, we are the only customer that has ever ordered the aluminum topped hot plates. And the heat shield that they had in there was for their ceramic topped hot plates, which did not work with the aluminum ones. So that the engineer they sent out here spent 3 days replacing all of those heat shields. Okay. So in the end, it worked out, but there was a tense week or so in there where I'm thinking, they're just gonna fire me because I royally screwed this up. But again, fortunately, worked out. And these hot plates have worked really well. But that was purchased in around 2003. We are at the end of the life cycle of these hot plates. We are losing about one or two a semester. And we're getting to that point where we no longer have enough really to replace them and so forth. So actually right now we're in the process of identifying replacement ones and so forth. Much easier this time around because websites are much better, and we ordered three or four of them as an individual one, brought them in, and we've looked at them and so forth. It was a much easier process. Besides that though, because these hot plates are kind of on the end of their life, getting up to that temperature is a little bit difficult. And so we do have to coax it along. We are, of course, going to be using our aluminum heating blocks. There's a cylindrical hole in there that fits your conical vial. And then you want to wrap the edge of the conical vial that's above the aluminum block with aluminum foil. Okay, so we're just kind of really getting as much of that heat directed to that conical vial as possible. And it will take a while. We're gonna make sure you put your thermometer in there to monitor the temperature, and it will hover at 100 degrees for quite a while, because initially we have to add water to this reaction. Triethylene glycol is really viscous, and getting everything dissolved is a little bit tricky. So we add a little bit of water, everything goes into solution, and then we have to boil off all of the water. Okay, so it does take a little bit of time to get the water completely out of there. But once it leaves, once it is all evaporated, you'll kind of see the temperature just, you know, start increasing rapidly. And once you get to the between 210 and 220, you want to hold it there. Okay? All right, so again, heating is a physical limitation of our equipment. We can do it, we just have to make sure we're helping it as much as possible. And lastly, this is the one that I care the most about, is the safety side of it. You're basically cranking the hot plate to 300. Okay? And you need to be aware that this is going to be hot for a significant period of time. And it's real easy to forget that. We were very, very used to wearing gloves with working with chemicals. And obviously we want to do that, but not when we're working with a hot plate. Okay? Because gloves, nitrile gloves, they're basically plastic. You accidentally brush the glove on the hot plate, it's going to melt immediately. It's going to melt to your skin, and the only way you can get it off is to sacrifice a layer of skin pulling those gloves off, okay? Excuse me. So when you're working around the hot plate, don't have gloves on, all right? Which means you need to be extra careful when handling all of the chemicals, all right? We need to be extremely careful after we take the conical vial off of the hot plate, because the conical vial, it's at 220 degrees C and it's glass. It's going to take a long time to cool down to a temperature where it is safe to actually touch. Okay? It doesn't look much different than a regular piece of glassware, but you don't want to accidentally pick it up. And ask me how I know. The problem with picking it up is it takes a split second for your nerves to send that signal to your brain your brain to catalog and decide what that signal actually means and send the response back to your hand, which is, that's really hot, this really hurts, let go. And unfortunately, in that split second, you've usually picked it up off the bench. When you let go, gravity, sample all over the place, etc. Okay, so just be aware of that fact. In other words, which I have said with chemicals multiple times, this is a real serious chemical, be very attentive when using it. Same thing goes here with the hot plate. Be aware of the fact that it is really hot. Be aware of the fact that your conical vial is going to be really hot for a long period of time. Okay? Because we really want to avoid burns. Now, if that accidentally happens, we do have burn cream in our first aid kit and so forth. So we will take care of you if an accident does occur, but let's hope that that isn't necessary. Okay, so we have made the 3-nitrothalhydrazide. Well, luminol, this nitro group, is an amine. And all we need to do to convert the nitro group to the amine is a reduction. So this is the second reduction we're doing, and we're using sodium thiosulfate. It also is called sodium dithionide. There's a couple names for it. It's just a different reducing agent than sodium borohydride. Same result is going to happen. We're going to reduce the nitro group to the corresponding amine, and we get luminol. Now, why do I say luminol is my favorite experiment? It's because what you can do with luminol. If you take luminol and add a base to it, like sodium hydroxide, and an oxidizing agent, like, say, hydrogen peroxide, you get a reaction where you release nitrogen gas, convert the amide back to the carboxylates, and you also release a photon. This is what we call a chemiluminescent reaction. And that just simply means a reaction where light is produced. In layman's terms, this thing glows in the dark. Okay? And this is one of those experiments that is perfect for your generation. Because we're not having to wait a week for our solid to dry, to take the melting point, to, you know, collect all of the data. We are going to know within a second, did we produce luminol or not? Perfect for you guys. You get instant gratification or disappointment. Most of you should get gratification though. And every time I do it, you follow the instructions, you follow procedure, you make the product, but there's that, did I actually succeed? And then you add the base and the oxidizing agent and it glows in the dark and it's just awesome. Okay. So, data analysis for this experiment, data collection, and really simple. Did it glow? If it glowed in the dark, yep, you made luminol. Now, we really like everybody to have success for this reaction. We want 100%, did it glow? Yes. It's very difficult in a teaching lab. It's actually very difficult in any lab. Sometimes you run a reaction and something goes wrong. It's just like baking, making toast or whatever. Sometimes you make a mistake and it doesn't come out like you planned. So one of the ways that we can help is if we start combining products. And so if we add two or three people's products to one sample, and it glows in the dark, then you have to conclude that it was my luminol that I added to the mixture that caused it to glow in the dark. Okay, so it's a way of, you know, getting 100% success without having every single one of you to test it. Now, of course, you can test your own on your own. You don't have to pair up or whatever. But if you're a little bit nervous, pair up with a couple of people and then do the reaction. Okay. All right. So what's going on? What releases? Oh, you need to say something before that, before this. And that is that luminol, even though it's a lot of fun, has an actual important role in modern society, and that is in crime investigation, crime scene, what do they call that? Forensics, okay. Luminol is used to detect the presence of blood. And when I was designing this experiment for the lab way, way back, I was thinking about, you know, my biology lab that I took as an undergraduate, where we did, there were like 3 weeks in a row that we called the blood labs. You tested your blood type. Were you anemic? Did all sorts of things on your blood. I don't know if they still do that in biology today. But when I was an undergraduate, and we were doing those labs, they didn't supply blood. They said, you got about 5 pints in you, that's more than enough. And they gave you a razor blade, an alcohol swab, and a Band-Aid. And you picked a finger, and that's just the way it was, all right? This dumb 18-year-old kid, well, that's what they're telling to me, telling me to do, slice it open. And I was thinking, okay, well, I got lots of ethanol. I don't get it in little swabs. I get it in a 5-gallon bucket, okay? I've got lots of Band-Aids, and I've got lots of razor blades. And so when I was designing this, I was like, this would be really cool. Everybody slice their finger open, you know, create a crime scene, and then use your luminol to see if it actually works. That would be, I mean, that, if you just think about that aspect of it, it's a really cool idea. It's like, wow, this thing could actually work in, you know, a modern forensic setting. Then I started looking into waste disposal. And I don't know how those biology labs deal with this stuff. I deal with chemical waste disposal, which is significant red tape, but it's manageable. When you get into biohazardous waste, it goes up several levels because it's not just, okay, throw it in here and you're done with it. No, you have to take care of it to make sure that the biohazard is completely inert now, all right? It is not fun, much more paperwork. And so I'm thinking, no, it's a great idea, but I think I'm just gonna have to skip it. Fortunately, however, we can answer that question without having to use blood. So we can actually use a molecule called potassium ferricyanide. In our light generating reaction. And you'll notice potassium ferricyanide has an iron in it, and the iron in potassium ferricyanide is exactly the same state as the iron in blood when you are testing it. And it is the iron in the blood that is allowing that reaction to take place. Okay, so not only do we get that instant, yes, it worked, it's really cool, it's glowing in the dark, but we can also say, hey, if there had actually been real blood in this reaction, it would have also worked as well. Okay, so even though we can't use real blood, we can still answer that question, which I think is, even though the light aspect of it is just cool, adding that in a real world scenario, this actually would work as well. That's something that just kind of adds to that, that this lab is awesome, all right? Okay. So the synthesis of luminol does have some safety aspects. They fall mainly, again, on the fact that you're using the hot plate at such a high temperature, so everything is related to all the high temperatures and so forth. Takes about 2.5 hours to possibly 3. It is a slightly longer lab, but that payoff at the end far outweighs the extra time you're going to be in there, all right? So what's going on to create this photon? And it all has to do with electrons and whether or not they get excited. So electrons typically exist in what we call the ground singlet state, which is indicated here by S0. This is their happy place. During the course of a reaction, one of the electrons can absorb energy. The energy comes from heat. It can come from chemical energy, you know, breaking a bond. However energy is entered into the system, an electron absorbs that energy and moves into an excited singlet state. And they're listed as S1, S2. Depends on how much energy is actually absorbed. Remember, they're kind of quantized and such. So you can go to an S2 if you absorb this much energy, you go to S1 if you absorb this much energy, and so forth. And then that's as far as I'm going with that explanation, because we've actually just dipped our toe into the quantum mechanics side of the pool. And I don't like swimming in that side of the pool, because I like to know if I'm in the water and where I'm swimming. All right? So regardless of how the electron gets excited, regardless of what level it gets excited into, the electron doesn't want to keep that energy. It wants to get rid of it and go back down to its ground state. And how it does this determines whether or not a photon is released. So within each individual level, there are what we call vibrational levels. Best way to think about this is you're sitting, you're really excited about something, whatever it is, but you can't stand up, you can't do anything, so you just sit there and you're just shaking. That's kind of the best way to think about vibrational energy, okay? You're getting rid of that excess energy by just, vibrating. And most of the time, that's exactly what happens. The electron is excited and then basically runs down the vibrational ladder, getting rid of all of that energy, just simply by shaking it off, essentially. Another thing that can happen is if you are in an excited singlet state, rather than running down the ladder, you just jump. You jump straight to the ground state. Now, when you release all the energy at once when you do this, this is when a photon is released. And this is called fluorescence. Okay? So if you're in an excited singlet state, you release all of the energy at once to go to the ground state, you release a photon, and that is called fluorescence. So that's the second way it can get rid of the energy. There is a third way. The third way is you go from an excited singlet state to an excited triplet state. Now, here's where we actually need to define this term singlet and now triplet. So a singlet state, if you remember, if two electrons are in the same orbital, they have opposite spins, the +1/2 and the -1/2. That's what the ground singlet state means. They are spin coupled or spin paired. So if the electron moves to an excited singlet state, it's still spin paired with the electron in the ground state. However, you can spend a little bit of that energy and flip. So you move up to this excited singlet state and then spend a small amount of it and flip your spin. When you are no longer spin coupled to the electron down in the ground state, you're now in a triplet state. Okay, so a triplet state, you are not spin paired. A singlet state, you are spin paired. Okay, so we've spent a little bit of that energy to get into the triplet state, and then basically the same thing happens again. We're still in an excited state. Once in the triplet state, it can run down the vibrational ladder, or it can release all of the energy in the form of a photon, and this is called phosphorescence. So both phosphorescence and fluorescence is the release of a photon. The absolute definition is if you're in an excited singlet state and you release the photon, that's fluorescence. If you are in an excited triplet state, that is phosphorescence. Okay? Well, how do you know? Okay, there are some physical characteristics. So, one is time. Fluorescence is usually extremely fast, usually in an order of milliseconds to possibly seconds. And phosphorescence is seconds to even longer, tens of seconds or whatever. It's a much, much longer process. There is the second one, which is color. So we all know E equals H nu. H is Planck's constant. Nu is the frequency of whatever wavelength is being released. But the energy is being released all at once. Now remember, in the excited singlet state, it is slightly higher in energy than the corresponding excited triplet state. Because you have to spend a little bit of that energy to get into the triplet state. And then you have to spend a little bit back when you're going down to the singlet state. Because you have to be spin paired when you're in the same ground state as the other electron. So the amount of energy released in fluorescence is higher than the amount of energy in phosphorescence. So if you have higher energy, then you have a higher frequency. Higher frequencies mean lower wavelengths, and so fluorescence tends to be blue / green. And phosphorescence tends to be reddish. Now, these are just physical characteristics. There are, of course, exceptions to everything, because the energy released is however much energy happens to actually be there. It doesn't really matter if it's red. It could still be fluorescence if the fluorescent amount of energy is in the red frequency, okay? So how do we know absolutely, all right? You guys don't need to remember this. This is not gonna be on the quizzes or anything like that. But you actually can tell by using what's called electron spin resonance spectroscopy. We can look at the spin state of the electron. So you can follow it. It's like, oh, it's a singlet state. All of a sudden, it's a triplet state because we know the spin state of the electron. And that is exactly what happened, what kind of state it's in when the photon is released. This has to be phosphorescence. Or nope, the electron is still spin coupled when the energy is released, so this has to be fluorescence, okay? Now that's an extremely diluted explanation of how it actually works, But ESR is one of the best tools you can use. So again, if you're kind of into spectroscopy, I highly recommend looking into this because the work they do with it is actually really, really cool. You're not just looking at fluorescence, you're looking at a whole bunch of other processes that happen by looking at the spin resonance of the electrons. Okay, so one last little bit is, how does nature do this? So we've all hopefully heard about fireflies. When I was a kid, in the evening, my parents would say, run around and catch a whole bunch of fireflies, put them in a jar, and they would glow, right? And so they get us running and running and running right before bed. As a parent, I now know exactly why they were doing that. Because all that running does what to you? You get tired. And so in the summertime, my parents would say, go chase fireflies, knowing that in about 30 to 40 minutes, we will all be exhausted. Hey, guess what? It's bedtime. You release the fireflies, you go to bed. Okay? In nature, chemiluminescence is simply called bioluminescence. And that just means it's happening within a biological system. And there's always an enzyme involved, okay? But regardless, it is a chemiluminescent reaction because a photon is being released. Okay, so what about amides in nature? Well, hopefully you all know about proteins, and proteins are simply long chains of amino acids where the carboxylic acid of one amino acid forms an amide linkage with the amino end of another carboxylic acid. It's called a peptide bond. Nature doesn't do this at 230 degrees Celsius. It's happening at, you know, body temperature, okay, 97 degrees Fahrenheit. And I think that's around 37°C. I haven't looked at that exactly, but I believe that's about what it is. So how does nature form this extremely important bond without using excess heat? Well, they use something called a transfer NRA. So the transfer NRA is bonded to the carboxylic acid. Transfer RNA, of course, the main purpose is to get it to that amino acid to the ribosome in that specific spot in making the peptide, okay? It also serves the double purpose of, this is an excellent leaving group. So in essence, it is very, very similar to an acyl chloride. Really good leaving group. And that's what the transfer RNA's second function is, okay? So in nature, it uses molecules for multiple purposes, usually because that's the most efficient way to do it. All right, so as I said, extremely fun lab. Everybody, at about 2.5 to 3 hours, you'll start to see the glowing. It is a really, really cool bluish-green glow. One thing I want to point out is that luminol is a little bit different. When it gets excited, it immediately goes into a triplet state and then goes back to a singlet state. And then the photon is released from the singlet state, all right? So one of the things you need to remember is there is no limit. You can go from a triplet to a singlet, back to a triplet. You know, you can keep going as long as you have enough energy to get down to that particular state. If you don't have enough energy to go down, you're stuck wherever you are, okay? Okay, like I said, 2.5, 3 hours, etc. Okay, I would like to talk one little bit before I go goodbye. We say goodbye for the second to last time. Next week is the end of the summer. Yay! My lab ends on the 14th. Fall semester for me starts on Monday. I get a weekend. That's okay, because they're paying me, so, you know. But anyways, I want to talk a little bit about green chemistry. This is the last time for the semester. So last week I wasn't in town. I was actually down in Houston attending a safety conference that is hosted by ExxonMobil. And we do a lot of, you know, what's going on in the industry, how are they addressing safety and so forth. And one of the things that they do with us when we're there is we get to tour the plants, okay? And coming from the perspective of a lab chemist, seeing humongous reactors doing a simple reaction just blows your mind, okay? I'm always, you know, every time I get to see a new process, it's just really, really cool to see it. They took us to a new plant this time, someplace that I had never been before. And there were two things going on that actually tied directly into green chemistry. So the first is when you're drilling for oil, one of the best ways that we're doing now when you're going into shale is what we call fracking, okay? And what that means is the shale is squished together and in between there's some oil. You get the oil out by simply prying apart the shale by pumping pressure into there. Well, when you start sucking out the oil, that's going to decrease the pressure, which will simply cause the shale to collapse again. So how do you keep it open while you draw out the oil? Fracking is basically taking water with sand in it and pumping it down into the well. And the way they've been doing this for decades, this has been going on for a really, really long period of time, is they set up a tank full of water, they set up a tank full of sand, they combine them, and with a high pressure pump, pump it down into the shale. And as you can imagine, you can only do this with one well at a time. So it can take a lot of energy just to move this whole process to the next one. And I don't know if you've ever been into an oil field. If you go down into you know, Floresville, Karn City, and that area down there, there's a whole bunch of oil wells down there. And you see what's called a pad, and there can be 4, 5, or 6 pump jacks on it. So you can imagine, if we're going to do fracking, we can do one well at a time. Well, the new process is they've created, which as they described it, a couple of engineers in the field got together, drew out an idea on a napkin, and he showed me the napkin and sent it in and said, hey, do you think this is possible? And basically what it is they designed a whole new system where they can deliver the sand and the water to up to 6 individual pump jacks at a time. And so that is going to save a lot on energy. You don't have to move it from one to another as often. And setup time is going to be faster. Tear down time is going to be faster. So overall, it's decreasing the energy input to get the oil out of the ground. And that is a green chemistry concept. We are decreasing what we have to spend to get what we want, okay? The second one, and this one blew me away, is I was not aware that ExxonMobil has a really high-quality cell biology lab. Totally, I don't know, why in the world are they focusing on cell biology? Well, very specific reason. Because there's a lot of what we call anaerobic bacteria out there. And they love something called H2S. Guess what has a lot of H2S? Oil. And so when they're pumping all the oil through pipes, there is a bunch of bacteria living in the pipes, feeding off of that HO2 in the pipes. And so they're studying this because they showed us a cutout of a 1-inch piece of steel pipe that was a 4-inch diameter pipe that had a hole in it all the way from one end of the inside to almost the outside of the pipe. Looked like a bullet hole because the anaerobic bacteria basically clamped onto that area of the pipe. They're getting all the H2S and now they're eating the iron and they're just going through. And they can ruin that pipe within a year. And so they're working on technologies to deal with all of that bacteria. One of the ways they're doing it, anybody know how we control hot water heaters from just dying very quickly due to hard water? We put a sacrificial metal in there, usually zinc. And all the hard water eats all of that, allowing your hot water heater to actually survive longer. So they're basically thinking, hey, if we have this piece of iron that's sitting in there that isn't part of the pipe, this bacteria can sit on this piece, eat that, and it's not going to affect the pipe. Other things they were working on too. So that is another form of green chemistry because, again, they're saving pipe. It's a lot of work to pull out these huge pipes, shut everything down, pull the pipe out and replace it. Very dangerous in many cases, etc. Okay, so I am going to put up another green chemistry quiz. Again, you don't have to take it. It'll be 100% optional. And it's just going to compare what you said in the beginning with that. We're trying to collect some data about this and your thoughts on green chemistry and so forth. Okay. One other quick thing, I know. I sent out an announcement that the surveys are available. On the left-hand side, when you log into Canvas, you should say survey as a link. You click on that and you fill out the survey. These surveys are actually really important. I read all of your comments. And some of you can be pretty hurtful, which is okay. But I have actually gotten I always get useful information out of them. For instance, this semester, the reason why we have the practice quizzes is because of comments that were made in the surveys. The reason why we have the note system that I have created is because of comments in the surveys, okay? So I implore you, without any added benefit, to please fill them out. But in the announcement, I know most of you are like, I don't care. I'm done with OChem Lab. I'm out of here. Screw the next generation. So I have been trying to entice you. So that is why if you're in a section and your individual section gets above 90%, 95% participation, I replace everybody's lowest quiz score with your quiz average. Your grade's going up. If the lab gets 100% participation, I know that's very high, but if I can get 100% participation, I drop everybody's lowest quiz. All grades are going up, okay? So if that's not enough to entice you guys, then I honestly don't know what will work, except maybe tickets to a UT game. Probably not. Anyways, thank you all very much. You guys have yourselves a wonderful day, and we will see you in lab. Oh, crap. I got a good one, too.
Okay, we'll get two next time, maybe.
What do you call an espresso with a cold?
What?
A coffee.
Oh, that's a good one. I need to open it.
it up next time with that one.
Yes.
I emailed you about my missed lab 2 weeks ago.
Okay. So can you make my office hours at 3 o'clock?
Today.
Today.
I'm not sure I can.
Okay, so can you make my office tomorrow at 11?
I think so.
See me tomorrow at 11 and we'll take care of you then.
Okay.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
I need to
see. Uh-huh.